Okay, I think we are all back. So let's start with the feedback session, and we will start with group four, which is Tuck.
Thank you. I think we had a very, very interesting, good discussion. So we first talked about the location of the information, IFRS information. Should we allow having IFRS information outside of the financial statement? So the first question we discussed was that what is the definition of annual report? Because although we allow to have a cross-reference within the boundary of annual report, we don't have the clear definition of annual report. And some users said that as long as it's a single document, location doesn't really matter. So that it should be readable. As long as it's readable, location doesn't really matter. However, the problem is the question of audit, to what extent it should be audited. So as you know, that only the financial statement would be audited, and normally annual report is not really audited. And the problem of annual report is in some jurisdiction it is heavily regulated, but in some jurisdiction there is no regulation on the annual report. So then one user said that financial statement in itself should be standalone and complete. So therefore, basically, every material information should be contained in the financial statement. So then the important threshold is rather materiality than the nature of the information. So if it's really material, then it should be within the financial statement. That is the most important principle. And then, so if it's a material, then even if the information is not IFRS information, even if it is non-IFRS information, it should be contained in the financial statements. So that is the comment I received in this discussion. And the other question is the duplication between the financial statement and the annual report. So some user complained to read same thing twice is quite burdensome for the readers. And for the readers, you don't know until you complete reading. And then in the end, it is completely same, but sometimes it is different. So then what is the difference? That is the question. The one preparer said there should be the difference. The difference is important. So therefore, even if there are lots of duplication, as long as the purpose of MD&A and the financial statement is different, so then duplication is fine. So then we couldn't reach the conclusion whether duplication should be avoided or duplication is acceptable. But the most important thing is the document as a whole should be readable one. That is the most important things. And the other important notion is somehow true and fair view. So if you say the financial statement, the threshold is materiality, it should be based on the concept of true and fair view. So then the second question is about the accounting policy. So when we discuss accounting policy, the most important question is what is the target audience? So do target audience know enough knowledge of accounting or not? And we know that in our conceptual framework, we do not specifically saying that the audience must be assumed to have accounting knowledge. So therefore, to provide accounting policy information is very important. Then we discussed whether category two type of accounting policy is really necessary or not. And we agreed that if it's really category two, then we don't really need it. But the question is, how can we define the category two? So say, for example, if the no accounting policy is explaining about IS 18, then not many users need it. But question is, if it relates to the future of the company, so future accounting procedure, then those informations are important, for example, like IFRS 15. So therefore, some people raised the good proposal. We have category 1, category 2, category 3, but we should include the new category, which is saying that accounting policy, which has an impact of the future of company, not necessarily now. So those categories could be important. And then we discussed about what the location of the accounting policy. Some preparer said the flow of accounting policy and the accounting standard, accounting number is very important. So it must be located closely. But some users said that accounting policies should be in the same location. So it's much easier. However, we agreed that it should be leave it to the judgment of the preparers, so even though there should be fragmented, but it should be left to the judgment of the preparers. So those are the main feedback from our group.
Okay, thanks, Tak. Any further comments from members of the group?
I'm going to try and summarize. True duplication should be avoided unless it impacts readability. At the risk of my colleagues disagreeing with me, was that a fair summary?
I think so.
Okay. Seems so. Yeah.
Frankly, I'm surprised.
Okay, then we move to the next group, which is the boardroom group, and Steve.
Thank you. So in terms of moving stuff out of the financial statements, we were very consistent with tax group. So yes, okay, as long as it's within the same reporting package, so the annual report, there was no real desire to move it onto the website, for example. In terms of moving things into the financial statements, the non-GAAP measures, acceptance that that can be very useful, the non-GAAP performance measures. And then we started to go wider and wider, and people got more and more nervous. So number of web clicks, constant currency type profit measures, order information, and the further that went, the more concern people started to raise. And also, Tak mentioned the audit question. That question came up as well, and the confusion about what is and what isn't audited was mentioned. And then on the accounting policies, I think my group was perhaps slightly more reluctant to go down the route that Tak had. So there wasn't a great deal of support for omitting the category 2 accounting policies. I tried to push it as hard as I could, but it didn't really work, and people were saying, no, we do need this. And acceptance, if it's not material, fine, but all the other stuff, I think there was a lot of reluctance to lose it. There was a great support, though, for perhaps communicating better and the location of the accounting policies being, rather than in one block, distributed and put into a more relevant place within the financial statement, so to aid communication. So I think that was a common theme as well.
I just ask, because we discussed it, in category 2, is it just a recitation of what the accounting standard says? A summarized recitation of the accounting standard?
Yeah, that's the question I asked. Mm-hmm. I said yes.
And they still want that instead of going to a website or something for that, knowing what the accounting should be.
We didn't really talk about it, but I don't think we were wanting a cut and paste of the IAS book. I mean, I think I'm not sure we talked about it, to be fair, Steve. So in my view would be...
I detected that some of the investors in the group...
I think there is elements of cut and paste in accounting policies today, or large elements of it. I think then we kind of moved into the location question. So I gave the example of my own experience where I serve very experienced credit analysts, and quite often I will, sometimes I will get questions that they don't understand how this particular disclosure works, and they've skipped over the 15 pages of accounting policy where it explains it. And these are not, you know, naive or amateur people, these are experienced credit analysts. So where we have some banks have started to move accounting policies to the relevant note, it works a lot better. And I think what we'll find over time, and maybe it's an optimistic assumption, is as more companies do that, those notes will actually get shorter and more relevant. So not quite answering your question, but I think at the moment the cut and paste isn't the big issue. I think the issue is that they're not looked at in great detail.
I just wanted to focus, and maybe it wasn't discussed, but because we had a discussion of what really is Category 2, because it's an exclusion, and I believe, and others can disagree, is Category 2 is just a summarization of exactly what the IFRS statement says, and then as preparer, I'm just trying to understand why I need to put it in there. It seems like you should have an understanding of what that says. But you know what that will do is cause these 15-page notes. If that's what you want, I guess we'll put it in there and give you a summarization of the standard, if that's what it is. I'm just surprised.
Two things. One is, Stephen, I don't know if I'm misrepresenting, but I thought our view was that we didn't really fully understand Category 2, and we think it's material or it's immaterial. So that's, I think, what we kind of conclusion on. I think, Bob, to your point, your preparers, you're in the accounting departments, you're living and breathing accounting every day. Analysts are not. Now, they will have a knowledge of accounting in many respects much better than myself as an accountant, but they won't have detailed knowledge, and there's no harm, in my view, in including some of the stuff that is, in your view, just saying what everybody else does because they have to do it. But I would say, just to repeat myself, is that as the location starts to move, I'm very confident that those disclosures will get more and more relevant. Because I think even reviewers, like the board of directors, when they're reviewing the annual statement, I guarantee you they probably skip over those accounting pages and they focus on the back. So that's, it doesn't get reviewed beyond compliance review and legal review, I think.
I also had a question to you. Can you give us some examples of non-IFRS information that is so material that it should go into the financial statements? Because it sounds to me like this is really opening Pandora's box. Have a run a science or consulting company, you would have to say in the PPE disclosures that your people are much more important than your PPE, and tell you everything about your scientists or how.
The one example was intangibles. The more information about the intangibles that was raised by Mark. So we didn't discuss what type of information, but just as an example. So if you have a huge amount of intangible which is not really recognized in the financial statements, but it is really material, you could include it with a clear label that this is not an IFRS information. So that's what our group people said, and there was no strong disagreement.
Okay. My view is that we need to be very careful that there is sort of a boundary between financial and non-financial information.
It was kind of a higher level point. So to your example, you said in your example, I think people would be much more important for this company than their physical locations. And so that would be I would assume much more important information for you. And it was a higher level comment of that there's so much resources and focus on what some said is the primary document, and others have commented that it probably has 10%, 20% of the useful information. And so we all know these things about audited, non-audited, and unreliable information. But I think the point was, in your example, I think the most important thing would be the people information, not the physical asset information. And that gets to, when people talk about the primacy of financial statements and footnotes, it just, to me, there's a primacy there, fine, but the primacy is based on 10%, 20% of the information you really want. That's where we kind of fall off. But it's a higher level of the conversation, that's all. That was the context.
You don't own the people, you own the assets.
What's that?
Difficulty is that you don't own the people, you own the assets.
That's an accounting construct. All we're just trying to make is, what in her example, what's most informative, and it would be people would be much more informative. So the accounting construct is you don't own the people, but in my personal view, that's the problem where we are now, where we have these tremendous, I'm going to repeat myself, but tremendous resources, internal controls, people saying primacy, go to the financial statements first. It's only giving you about 10 to 20% of the information you really desire. It's turned into a compliance exercise, but it's, you know, I can be red in the face and we'll devil down into the details and say you don't own people. I agree, but that is the most important information for the example of the company she gave. And just because we don't own them, sounds like, well, okay, whatever. Anyways.
Okay, Mata?
Just make comment on possibly including summaries of accounting policies in financial statements. I think it's not really useful to have every annual report every year trying to explain by including summaries of accounting policies into the financial statement. It's just not, it doesn't really educate. If you want to understand IFRS, maybe IFRS Foundation should support that by producing those on their website, and the company states we apply IFRS. So there's no need to include those summaries. And if anything, those summaries tend to disguise or hide, or not intentionally, but make it very difficult to identify the relevant bits and pieces. How was the policy applied? The company specific, and that's exactly what's already in the proposition and in information in category one. So from this big case for not including summaries in the significant accounting policies.
Valendra?
Yeah. Now this is on the question of disclosing IFRS information outside the financial statements and vice versa. It has a lot of ramifications. I mean, I was not in this group, so I would like to understand from this group, was the ramification discussed in the sense that we'll have ramification at the time of audit? The auditor will be, even though there is a cross-reference, the auditor will be cross-referring something which is appearing in another part of the annual report. Secondly, if my local regulator is wanting me to file the financial statement, I'll be filing the financial statement. That will not be good enough because the financial statement will have a cross-reference. And then, see, in other words, I have to file the entire annual report to the regulatory authorities, which we are not doing now. Was this point discussed in this?
This was discussed, this particular topic. Yeah. And the way we tentatively identified a solution is that you can reference, you possibly could make a reference, include, for example, maybe operating segment information in the MD&A, if the MD&A is an integral part of the same document filed. So there, and then you can, from IFRS, say, if you include in the same document, you can say it should be considered as an integral part of the financial statement from an audit perspective.
But there are many geographies where the MD&A is not considered as a part of the financial statement.
Then it's very difficult.
So then,
to do
then,
that.
That's not possible. Then.
Maybe in that case, it's not possible.
Again, we did discuss it. It's a higher level concept, and I don't think people like to stay at the higher level because it's not concrete enough to them. But the fact is we're in this paradigm right now of what our existing structure is, which I agree, and there's problems with that. But I think, in my personal opinion, we're spending 80% of our resources on a thing that provides about 20% of the information people actually need, and that's the conundrum, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I think there's all these things of this is audited, this is not audited, but the conversation, our conversation was trying to rise above that to say maybe it'd be better to spend 80% of the resources on 80% of the information that people want and then try and figure out alternative ways of differences from the construct right now, which is audited versus non-audited. I would just say in my experience working for a company, you know, the financial statements is important for recognition, but when you look at disclosure, it's a compliance document, treated as a compliance document. All the sexy information's done in the earnings call and analyst information. So if we want to have the information stream exclude us as a profession, fine, let's continue what we're doing, but that's my soapbox, and I'll probably not get off of it.
A little bit back to the discussions this morning, and Peter?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to what Osman was referring to, this accounting principles connected to the footnotes. I think that's a very good way to treat it. But when I look at this category 1, 2, and 3, the category 2 to me was previous category 1 that didn't really change this year. And then, okay, should we include it? Yes, to me, definitely include it, because it may change the next year. Category 3 is the one that you're referring to. These ones we don't use. I mean, so why even bother to include it? So that's the distinction I did between the 1, 2, and 3. And then I would love to comment a little bit about on Bob's 80 to 20 separation in this. I mean, you're working for one company and you know everything in that company. I'm working with several companies. I throw out companies. I go into new companies all the time. To dig into the annual report is a tremendous source of information. Tremendous source of information.
I was being kind. It's really 90-10, not digging.
Yeah, well, that is not to be kind. Yeah, we can have a fist fight about that. I mean, you need to start somewhere. So I think it's a tremendous source of information, and the quarterly
economy is one more time and not catch up.
But again, also going back to Bob's issue, that is very much about non-IFRS information. From my view, at least, the 80% that you are referring to is the stuff that the ISB doesn't work with. So I think start excluding or prohibiting non-IFRS information being included in the financial report is not at least to please Bob in this issue.
Did you agree with that? That you agree with that?
Yeah, that I agree with.
Okay, Kevin and then.
So Mary, just to answer some of your Pandora's box. So as a gold miner, I honestly think you need to know gold sold and gold produced, which is non-IFRS. And also because I have a perception that, unfortunately, all of us are inherently lazy, you'd like to know persistency of Netflix subscribers, which is also non-IFRS. Because I don't know how many, a show of hands, how many people have ever cancelled their Netflix subscription. So you need to know that information. Yeah. It's all non-IFRS, but I think it's very vital.
I think I'll respond to that one more time.
In our group, we also talked about the importance of the primary financial statements and knowing where the boundaries are and what the audit opinion applied to, not only from the auditor's perspective, but the regulators of the auditors. So we did, you know, many people were focused on, you know, that needs to stay intact and you need to understand the boundaries.
Okay, thanks. And Mariana?
So, I mean, just coming back to you, but this is still like very much financial information, and to my knowledge, there has never been any sort of exclusion of like incremental financial disclosures in IFRS anyway. So, I mean, things like COGS and stuff that companies routinely report, it's not actually technically an IFRS number, but the way I understood you was that basically, I mean, it was almost like creating a general mandate to include anything that you think is really relevant to your business in the IFRS statements. And I just wanted to say, I think, even though I agree with Bob that a lot of this other 80%, 90%, whatever you call it, is highly relevant to my analysis, I love to have that separation between the primary financials and everything else, because they're just fundamentally very different bits of information. And what I really, really like about the primary financial statements is that it's basically a really merciless, objective scorekeeping method. And, you know, sometimes you can read the front section of the annual report, listen to an analyst call. If you don't know the company well, you think they have a brilliant future. And then you look at their financial report and you're like, oh my God, the numbers have been terrible for the last 10 years.
It's
and
cool.
You know, that is something that it's really, yeah. And this is what is really, really helpful. And then just very, very briefly, I wanted to say, in terms of accounting policies, one thing that would be very useful would be to disclose information that is highly relevant to future estimates. So a simple example, a company spends billions and billions of some acquisitions, and that was, you know, 8 years ago, and there's massive amortization of like a billion or something like that every year. A lot of times, you know, if you haven't followed the company super, super closely at the time, you don't really know whether that 1 billion amortization ends in 2018 or 2019. So, you know, just, you know, giving people, like, you know, those sorts of things where you're like, okay, watch out for the future, you know, this amortization period is coming to an end and then the amortization is just going to stop, or things like that. I think that would be much more helpful than trying to explain general accounting to people.
It's really interesting how a discussion about accounting policies can create such a... We have Malcolm and Marilyn, then we go to the next groups. Yeah? Malcolm.
Just two quick points. First of all, about duplications and picking up on Bob's point. I mean, generally, I would support that there's not duplication in the whole annual report package, but one has to be pragmatic. You couldn't take out of the income take out of the financial statements, say, the income statement, and cover that in detail in the MD&A and not have that in the financial statement. So I think the core, whatever you call them, end up calling them, the core financial statements have to be in the financial statements and can't be cross-referenced.
You're absolutely characterizing the conversation correctly.
Okay, and so I
if I didn't correct, if there's any confusion.
Now, when one gets to the notes, then, you know, we can talk about category or level one and two notes. I'm all against more insignificant notes being someplace else. On the second point, and here perhaps I'm being very old-fashioned in my approach, I do believe that the financial statement should only contain information which comes from the accounting records and the general ledger and covers assumptions relating to the valuation that goes into the balance sheet, the assumptions. So I do not believe, and I have always, all my career, said I don't believe financial statements should contain performance metrics like tons produced, like clicks, like cars produced or whatever, volumes. I don't believe those come out of the accounting records, and therefore I don't believe they have any place in the financial statements.
Okay, Murillo?
Just a concern about the possibility that information, that is non-IFRS information, being included in financial statements. It's because I've seen some situations involving regulatory agencies, laws requiring information that it's not IFRS to be included in financial statements. Because the financial statements enjoys a level of reliability that it's a very very desirable for these entities, these organizations, to have some specific information be included there. Because even if they are not audited, they know the information will be somehow scrutinized by the auditors. So there is some danger in there by allowing non-IFRS information to be included in the financial statements.
Okay, thanks for that. Okay.
Specifically on the topic of non-IFRS information, actually we observe companies doing some really very useful, innovative metrics on pro forma, on where if the rigor applied to IFRS is also applied to pro forma measures, they really add to the credibility of those numbers, which are extremely decision useful for investors. So I'm less hesitant for including non-IFRS. Even operating income is non-IFRS, and how could we have that's so there's lots of stuff that's actually already in there which is not damaging the financial statement at all. So with that experience in mind, and if there's additional guidance that the clear definition, consistent application, if the definition is changed, you have some comparable numbers, there are safeguards that can be included that non-IFRS at least still is rigorous and included in the financial statement.
I think we have more chances to discuss that when we come later to the primary financial statements, when we discuss this operating performance measure by management, and think that is a starting point, and think that leads into that. Okay, but then we go to Gary to give us feedback on the second group.
Okay, the goal of our group was to discuss centralized disclosure objectives and a couple alternative views that were expressed that might be ways to approach them going forward. I would probably say in general, I think our group kind of liked how we do it today, that the IFRS 16 approach with the reasonably developed objectives and some detailed guidance is probably the right way to do it. It sort of a hybrid of pure principles and a hybrid of pure lists. Regarding method B, which was sort of organize your disclosures by activity, say operating, financing, you know, whatever, general sense was that's really more management commentary, not primary financials, or not financial statements and footnotes type disclosures. That said, with a preference for largely doing how we do it today is find ways to make it better. And we're relatively new in terms of writing objectives at the beginning of the disclosure sections. It'll need some refinement and some work over time. I'll go off the discussion and say, you know, one concern I've had is, does that get boilerplate? Provide information, show us what happened to the accounts the prior year, and help us enable project future cash flows. And that could become boilerplate. That's sort of what it's about. We need to develop it more granularly and more workable. But one of the things that we need in addition to in developing better current form of writing disclosures is continuous reinforcement of materiality, both in terms of refining the concept as well as refining how you would actually apply materiality. And we didn't spend much time on our materiality practice statements and stuff, but certainly all rolling in the same direction. The room was actually generally okay with prescriptive lists of disclosures. It again, subject to we continue to develop materiality and keep reinforcing that materiality always applies. The preparers made a comment that I think the auditors, you know, we didn't have auditors in the room, I don't think, would agree with, that prescriptive lists actually help preparers to get the disclosures done. All too often in big companies, you need other departments or organizations to supply it. If you can point to it here, the rule says you've got to do this, it's a lot easier to get, as well as it's judgment and provide if important. Then you're into internal debating over how important is it and where is it that I have to do it. So don't lose sight of that there actually is an internal control helpfulness to that. The users in the hand were worried about a loss of comparability, that method B would, since it's organized around the functions of a company and how it's organized, well, companies organized very differently from each other in the same industry, so that impairs comparability. If you left the footnote disclosures at too high of a level, that would have problems with comparability. And they thought that, called the New Zealand approach, call it the core or more approach, again, the same problem, you'd lose a lot of comparability. So for all those reasons, we improve how we do it today, but don't go towards method B.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Before I open discussion, I think we first, from Suas, should hear what group one has discussed.
Thank you. We also discussed centralized disclosure objectives, and we got some similar feedback as Gary has summarized, but with different notes nevertheless. First of all, in terms of what we do today, the fact that we write prescriptive requirements is not an obstacle to providing relevant information, as long as materiality plays a significant role in what is produced. And materiality, I mean, in the light of the recent focus and emphasis that it has taken in our discussions, the situation outside has improved. But whether we write that, you know, to the extent that a requirement meets the objective is just unnecessary, because the materiality requirement should play that role. Nevertheless, participants, and whether it was users or preparers, indicated that materiality judgments are difficult to make. So the necessity is to have objectives, and objectives, just as Gary said, that are sufficiently defined specifically at the right level of granularity, that makes sense to people. And that materiality can be, materiality judgments can be made against those objectives which are sufficiently precise so that materiality can be expressed. A point that was made, in fact, is, and that could support materiality judgments more and also guide in the development of objectives, is to think of key metrics that users want to be able to dig out of financial information, and that would guide us in formulating the objectives. So that was more or less the comments on the situation today. Looking into the developments that could be made, in fact, the comments very much reaffirmed what we had already indicated in the first part of our discussion. Looking at method A and method B for centralized disclosure requirements, the same comment about comparability was made, as Gary has reflected, but differently from Gary's group, people saw merit in distinguishing between assets and liabilities that play a role in operating or financing or investing activities, because that gave a lot of insight into how the organization was operated. But in terms of, it should not guide necessarily the way disclosures are, objectives of disclosures are defined. In fact, participants saw that the two angles were necessary, and that eventually activities would be more a question of organization of the notes rather than the driving factor into the definition of objectives. And finally, looking at the New Zealand method, the point was again made that what is important are specific objectives to which people can relate, and that the distinction that the New Zealand method would introduce either was not completely clear or didn't have appeal.
Okay, thanks, Francois. Any further comments? Holding us away from lunch, or
it's at least as interesting as the notes, as the policies.